Om Ajnanatimirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chakshrunmilitam Yena Tasmaye Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Nigamakalpaturo Galitam Phalam Sukamukaram Ritadravasam Yutam Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Canto 7, Chapter 9. Prahlad pacifies the Lord with prayers. Text 27. Naisha Parabara Matir Bhavato Nanu Syaj. Janto yatatma surido jagatas tatapi. Samse vaya surataro evate prasada. Sevanu rupam mudayona paravaratvam. You have to learn how to chant the Sanskrit. One more. Any of you. You're all dumb or what? Not. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Unlike an ordinary living entity, my Lord, you do not discriminate between friends and enemies, the favorable and the unfavorable, because for you there is no conception of higher and lower. Nonetheless, you offer your benedictions according to the level of one's service, exactly as a desire tree delivers fruits according to one's desires, and makes no distinction between the lower and the higher. Please repeat. Unlike an ordinary purport. In the Bhagavad Gita 4.11, the Lord clearly says, Ye yatamam prapadyante tamstataiva bhajami aham. As one surrenders to me, I reward him accordingly. As stated by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Jivara Swarup Hai Krishnara Nityadas. Every living being is an eternal servant of Krishna. According to the service the living entity renders, he automatically receives benedictions from Krishna, who does not make distinctions, thinking, here is a person in an intimate relationship with me, and here is a person I dislike. Krishna advises everyone to surrender to him. Sarvadharmam paritjagya mamikam saranam braja. One's relationship with the Supreme Lord is in proportion to that surrender and the service one renders unto the Lord. Thus, throughout the entire world, the higher and lower positions of the living entities are selected by the living entities themselves. If one is inclined to dictate that the Lord grant something, one receives benedictions according to his desires. If one wants to be elevated to the higher planetary systems, the heavenly planets, he can be promoted to the place he desires. And if one wants to remain a hog or a pig on earth, the Lord fulfills that desire also. Therefore, one's position is determined by one's own desires. The Lord is not responsible for the higher or lower grades of our existence. This is further explained quite definitely in the Bhagavad Gita 9.25 by the Lord Himself. Janti Deva Brata Devan Pitrin Janti Pitri Vrata Bhutani Janti Bhuteja Janti Mamnya Jinopi Mam. Some people want to be promoted to the heavenly planets, some want to be promoted to Pitri Loka, and some want to remain on earth. But if one is interested in returning home back to Godhead, he can be promoted there also. According to the demands of a particular devotee, he receives a result by the grace of the Lord. The Lord does not discriminate, thinking, here is a person favorable to me, and here is a person who is not favorable. Rather, he fulfills the desires of everyone. Therefore, the Shastras enjoin, Akama Sabakamo Va Mokchakama Udharadhi Tivrena Bhakti Yogena Jajeta Purusham Param. Whether one is without desire, the condition of the devotees, or is desirous of all fruitive results, or is after liberation, one should, with all efforts, try to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead for complete perfection, culminating in Krishna consciousness. According to one's position, whether as a devotee, a karmi, or a jnani, whatever one wants, one can get if one fully engages in the service of the Lord. Unlike an ordinary living Krishna. Kartik Brat Ki Jai. So I was just asked to give this class about 20 minutes ago. So I haven't had any time to prepare for it, at least not this morning, because I've had 36 years otherwise, but that's not an excuse. So this is an important verse, because it describes the relationship of the Supreme Lord with all living beings. Samasabhisu Bhutishu, the Lord is equal to every living entity. But still he says, those who are favorable to him, because he reciprocates with every living entity, then it appears that he's being more favorable to his devotees than he is to anyone else. But from Krishna's point of view, of course, every living being is his devotee. Just that some of them, or most of them, remember that and are favorably disposed to his service, and some of them are forgetful and are therefore not doing direct service. But it's not that Krishna has a discrimination against those living beings who are not particularly inclined to render him direct devotional service. They're also his parts and parcels. They are part of him. So he doesn't discriminate in that sense against himself. Yeah? Every living being is a part of Krishna. We're not different from him in that sense. We are one with Krishna. But parcel means that we're only a small particle. We're just tiny compared to Krishna's, you know, unlimited nature. We have a very finite nature. But simultaneously one and different, achinchibheda bheda tattva. So this is very important to understand, especially in the material world, when we look and see the apparent discrimination that's going on here. Everybody's always yelling about discrimination, being discriminated against, particularly. People don't like it. Yeah, they get angry on somebody who has a better position than themselves, or they get envious of someone that is apparently more well situated than themselves. And so you see these kinds of movements, isms, communism, where people are agitating, you know, against the apparent better position or more opulent position or more favored position than another living being. And the tendency is to want to pull them down and then, of course, pull yourself up in that position. And such people, generally, they tend to be atheists. When they see that kind of so-called discrimination, then they immediately use that as evidence that how can there be God? Our Shivaram Maharaj, he was invited to debate with one scholar in England a couple of years back. That video is on the internet there. And the question was whether there is a God or not. Yeah. So this so-called philosopher, he was a professor, he was saying that he can't accept the existence of God because bad things happen to good people, basically. That there are so many innocent living beings, we see children, etc. They suffer in so many different ways from disease, you know, or from poverty, you know, or from abuse, or whatever it is, you know, being run over by a truck, or whatever. And what have they done for that? They haven't done anything to deserve it. Yeah, they're just little kids. They're pure. Yeah, they've just been born. They haven't had a chance to develop any kind of, you know, independent activity. So how is it that they have to suffer like that? So that, he says, is evidence that there cannot be a God. Yeah? Because he can't understand. If God is there, if God is love, yeah, if God is supposed to be equal to everyone, then why some so-called innocent people are being discriminated against, and God is not doing anything to help them. Yeah, there's so much suffering in the world. There are so many countries, people are living on the edge of starvation. Not just that, there are many thousands of living beings that are simply dropping dead every day from starvation. So why? And yet there are others that have so much opulence they don't know what to do with it. Yeah, building themselves 40-story high buildings as a residence. So, like that, they see and, oh, then how can there be a God? Then they reject the whole concept of God. But that means that they don't actually have a proper understanding of the position of God. And more importantly, they don't have an understanding of the relationship of the living beings with God. They don't understand the nature of the living beings. They don't understand the nature of the Supreme Lord. And therefore, they jump to false conclusions based on their own speculative ideas of what living beings actually are. So as long as we're on this bodily conception of life, where we cannot perceive the living beings as being eternal, then we run into immediate difficulties when we observe their apparent, you know, conditions of life and activities. If we look at people just in terms of their bodies, then immediately we make all these different judgments and discriminations. Yeah, this one's better than that one, this one's situated better than that one, this one's getting advantage, this one's getting disadvantage, like that. We make so many calculations about the relative positions of the living beings. But this, according to the Bhagavatam, is ignorance. Yeah. Even a person, you know, we see sometimes great altruists. So they have some feeling, oh, yeah, the living entities are suffering, let's help them. So they feed them or they clothe them or they, you know, they do some kind of activity to improve, you know, the medical facilities that are available or, you know, build houses for them, you know, dig wells and things like this. Fine. That's something, a little bit of help. But it's, if it's based on the idea that the person who's giving the charity thinks, you know, these living beings are their bodies, then that's also another manifestation of ignorance. Yeah? If you can't see what a living being actually is, what his real nature is, then how will you help them? Yeah? So, help, that means it has to be based on real education, a real understanding of what a living being actually is. Otherwise, if you're in ignorance, whatever help that you will try to give will actually, you know, generally speaking anyway, it will just extrapolate the suffering or the condition that the person's already in. Now we see that because people think that, oh, you know, we are just these bodies. All the help that they try to give is just simply on that bodily platform. Feed them and clothe them, or even if they try to educate them, all they do is educate them in how to make economic progress. As if, you know, the economy is the life air of every living entity. You know, you can see just in the last few weeks, mass panic all over the world. Everybody's throwing a fit. What will happen if the stock exchange crashes? Yeah? Because they all have this idea that their welfare is tied into the economy. And somehow or another, if there's not, you know, this frantic endeavor day after day, you know, 24/7, to always be improving the economy, yeah, always keeping the circulation of money going, you know, then somehow or another we're all headed for disaster. They don't realize they're already in a disastrous condition because they actually don't know that they're not this body. That's the real point. Whether you're a rich man or a poor man, you're headed for disaster. It's called jara vyadi, yeah, old age and disease, and then death, mrityu. Yeah, everybody's headed for that, doesn't matter how many dollars you've got in your pocket. So economic improvement and everything tied in with that, you know, any kind of so-called improvement of the bodily condition of life is just another manifestation of ignorance. It doesn't actually help that living being to improve his situation by doing all of these kinds of altruistic activities. What really improves the condition is to bring that living being to a sense of his true self. And that true self is apart from this body. That's the message of the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna tells Arjuna, just out of some sentiment for all these people that you think you know. You know, you're identifying and labeling them as friends and relatives, you know, as superiors or whatever. And you're lamenting because now you have to go out and kill them. But that is all foolish talk. Yeah, that's the talk of an ignorant person. And then he begins to educate him. The first education is that you're not this body. And as soon as you get that view of a living being as an eternal spirit soul and not this body, then so many things can be understood correctly. So especially this point about why living beings apparently being discriminated against in this material world. Yeah, why people are suffering, or why so-called good things happen to bad things happen to good people. Or sometimes the other way around, they use that argument, you know, good things happen to bad people. Yeah, we used to hear that all the time. In the early days of ISKCON, here in India, people would come and say, well, you say, you know, if Vedic culture, our Indian culture, if it's so glorious, why are we in such a miserable condition of life? And why are the atheistic Westerners, you know, so prominent and powerful and rich and like that? So they think that that's also a contradiction. So good things happening to bad people and bad things happening to good people, it becomes a bewilderment if you think that everybody is their body. But as soon as you understand that we're not this body, that we're eternal, then immediately you can understand why a 5-year-old child who was apparently pure and innocent, you know, has to suffer some kind of tribulation, physical or mental or whatever it is. Why? Because that living being has a very long history in this material world. It's not that they're only 5 years old and they've just come into being. Yeah. This is a mistake. The living being, Krishna says very clearly, he has not come into being, he does not come into being, he will not come into being. We've just been having a little discussion on the internet about some of the early editing work on Prabhupada's books. There's a sentiment amongst some devotees that in the 1972 first published unabridged edition of the Bhagavad Gita is the only edition that's authorized. And the 1983 edition, you know, which was a re-edit of that 72 edition, is somehow or another bogus because it was edited after Prabhupada's time and nobody has the authority to do that editing work. However, because there's a sentiment like that, don't change Prabhupada's books. But what is the actual situation? That requires a little bit of, you know, intelligent investigation. So, in terms of those two Bhagavad Gitas, the 83 edition is far, far more accurate and true to Prabhupada's original manuscripts than the 72 edition was. And one example is, you know, that verse. Never was there a time when I did... For the soul, you know, there is neither birth nor death. Now, in the original 72 edition, it says, nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. Yeah, he's unborn, he's eternal, he's everlasting, like that. Now in the 83 edition, it says, he does not come into being, he has not come into being, he does not come into being, and he will not come into being. Three phases of time, has not, does not, will not. These past, present, and future, Krishna very specifically says in the Sanskrit, he uses the three words which indicate the three phases of time, and he says, na, 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 not, 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 not the past, not this now, and not in the future does he actually come into being. He's eternal. There's no question of, you know, coming into being and then being eternal. So there was a mistake there that was made in the early edition, because the editor, he didn't think that Prabhupada's translation of the Sanskrit was very poetic. It was a bit clumsy and prose-like. He has not come into being, he does not come into being, he will not come into being. Oh, it doesn't sound poetic or, you know, stylish. So I'll borrow somebody else's translation, you know. Nor having once been, does he ever cease to be? Unfortunately, the person that he borrowed that from is an atheist. He was a Mayavadi, Dr. Radhakrishnan. And in his translation, that's exactly what he says. That the soul, you know, having once come into being, that's his translation. Yeah, having once come into being, then he does not cease to be. It's a bogus philosophy. It's not our philosophy. So there was a problem with that. But if you don't know, you know, the philosophy nicely, then of course you won't realize that, or you won't see that. But it's very, very important. The soul does not come into being. It has no point of origin. It's eternal, as the Supreme Lord is eternal. And therefore, he has this very, very long history. Yeah, he has a point at which he came into this material world. And there's a reason why he came into this material world. And from that point on, although we don't know, you know, the whole history, we can say what his activities have been in all his previous incarnations or appearances in various kinds of bodies. Now he's come into this body, but he's come into this body with a lot of baggage, as they say. You're coming into this relationship with a lot of baggage. Put your bags at the door and let's start fresh. That's, Krishna's also saying the same thing. Yeah. Now, if somebody comes and approaches Krishna, then he says, put all your baggage at the door. Yeah. Savadhamam paritjagya. All your ideas of what you think you are and what you think you ought to be doing, you know, so-called dharma, just put it all at the door and then come in. And then I'll immediately write off all your history. Yeah, we'll forget about all of that, all your past papa. Yeah, and let's start off fresh, you know, on this basis, that you are my eternal servant. Yeah, and this is your business as a spirit soul. So that's how Krishna approaches everything. But unfortunately, if we don't take notice of that, then we carry that baggage with us from one body to the next. We carry all, you know, these misconceptions of who we are and what we should be doing and all the desires that have arisen due to those misconceptions. They're all there within the heart. And they don't finish when the body finishes. Yeah? And they don't begin when this body begins. We carry them from one body to the next. They get modified as we're going along due to the association that we pick up and the ever-changing immutability of material nature. It's always there, but it's always changing. And due to, you know, those constant changes, because of our identification with it, our ideas of who we are and what we should be doing is always changing too. So in this way then, we're going from one body to another, and we're performing various kinds of activities. Yeah, which we think will fulfill our desires or make us happy. But more often than not, of course, they don't. They don't help us whatsoever, but they entangle us in the network, you know, of karmic action and reaction. So when a person comes into this body and they are in a situation which is apparently disadvantaged, don't blame the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Take the responsibility on yourself. Yeah, this is the actual praman that Krishna is teaching us. that every living being is responsible for his own position in this material world. He made an original decision at some point where he decided not to follow or to be with Krishna, not to serve Krishna in a favorable mood as a friend, you know, as a lover, as a parent or whatever, in one of these different rasas. He made a decision that he wants to be a competitor. He wants to have all the enjoyment. Why should Krishna have it? And from that moment on, then Krishna says, now you become responsible for your own activities. I'll supply to you whatever you need. Because even if we think we're not dependent on Krishna, we actually are. We can never be actually independent, but we get that mentality. So Krishna says, all right, I'll supply you whatever you need. Go ahead, here's a place you can pretend, you know, that I don't exist. And he's so kind that he even gives such personalities the intelligence to be able to think about theories that prove that God doesn't exist. Yeah. That intelligence also is coming from the Supreme Lord. It doesn't come from their own, you know, inherent abilities. So Krishna is very merciful. He supplies everything. But he also says very clearly that I do not take responsibility for the actions that you perform with the facilities that I provide to you. That's yours. You want to be the enjoyer. You want to be the controller. So then, all right, I give you that opportunity. Those who are in control, those that want to be enjoyers, you want the result, you get the result. I don't. I'll give you the facility, but don't try to lay the blame, if it's not very favorable for you, at my doorstep. This is what's being said here. Yeah, that every living being has to accept responsibility for his own activities. Even though it may, you know, at face value appear to be very bewildering or even abhorrent, yeah, that, oh, a child that has been abused in different ways, it's his fault. Is that what you're saying? That it's his fault? This is how the materialist thinks. Oh, here's a child, you know, he got some disease or he got abused by somebody else or he got run over or whatever it was. Oh, it's all his fault. How can you say that? They get very angry if you even suggest it. But that's because they're in ignorance of what the real nature of the soul or the living being actually is. If we understand this living being has performed so many activities in the past, and that when he comes into this body, now he's already got a stock of so-called good or bad reactions coming to him, then it becomes a lot easier to understand, you know, the situation of this material realm. Why there's apparently good and bad situations. The living beings themselves have desired it. You can say, oh, well, why would a person desire to be lying in the street as a beggar? Surely everybody desires to be, you know, living in a palace or on the heavenly planets. But do you really? I remember reading a story once about a scholar. This was just a few years ago. He had visited India. And he was observing. There was an old man. He had a small store. And, you know, he was selling whatever he sells. And he had his money there in a tin. And there were a couple of youths that were standing nearby, just idling around. They obviously didn't have jobs or anything. And he thought, well, you know, these young men, they could easily just walk up, grab all that money, and go off, and nobody would stop them. The old man's not going to stop them, you know, but why don't they do that? So he was kind of curious, sociological idea. So he went to the youths and he asked them, you know, you have the opportunity, you're fit and strong as this old man, you know, why don't you just help yourself? And they said, no, we won't do that. And he said, why? He said, because then we'll get so much bad karma. He said, the reason why we're suffering right now and why we're poor right now is because we were doing that in the past. Yeah? So this time round, we're not going to do it. So the scholar was shocked. just a couple of youths on the street. But they knew this philosophy, that yes, if we do this, we're fearful we'll get so many bad reactions, and in the future we'll have to suffer for that. So better not to do it from the very beginning. So they had modified their desires, so even if they had a desire, you know, for economic development, but they had modified their desire according to this knowledge that whatever actions they perform, they're sure to get a reaction, and that there are good ones and bad ones. And because they're suffering now, they don't want to suffer in the future, so they have to modify their behavior to guarantee their future. So the scholar was very impressed with that, that this is India's culture. Yeah, that even on the street level, ordinary people, they know this. Of course, nowadays, it's disappearing a little bit more. People are becoming a little bit, you know, swept up with this ignorance, this wave of ignorance that's coming from the Western countries in the form of economic endeavor. Yeah, everybody's getting like this meningitis, yeah, fever of the brain, get more money somehow or another. Money is the honey. Yeah, and they're rejecting their own culture. So Prabhupada used to lament about that a lot. I was just reading a lecture that Prabhupada gave in 1966. He was complaining about the same thing. Right from the moment that he set foot in America, Prabhupada was not bewildered, you know, by the so-called opulence of the American people. Although he would often tell his disciples, you know, you're born in good families, you've got good education, you have so many facilities like this, now make your lives complete by taking up Krishna consciousness. But for himself, when he arrived, you know, he wasn't like some of the so-called swamis and yogis that as soon as they set foot on the shores of America, they immediately, you know, their senses got agitated, their brains got agitated, and they started to think about how they could avail themselves of that opulence of the American people. Prabhupada wasn't like that at all. He was completely even. He saw the Americans in the same way that he saw the so-called poverty-stricken Indians. These are all spirit souls. They're here temporarily. They have this human form of life. They're in ignorance of who they really are. And therefore, they'll continue, you know, in this repeated process of birth and death. And their situation as so-called opulent, you know, powerful country, that it has no relevance, actually, to their real natures. So Prabhupada wasn't at all swayed or bewildered or bedazzled, you know, by the so-called opulence of America or any other country that he went to. Yeah. He had this equal vision that's being described here. He saw every living being, regardless of their relative position, as a bewildered spirit soul that needs help. Yeah, that if you really want to do good for others, para upakar, you know, you have to do good for others. This is Lord Chaitanya's instruction. But you can only do that on the basis of real knowledge. So one has to see the living beings as they actually are. And Prabhupada had that vision. And therefore he was effective all over the world to all classes of men. Yeah, to every different kind of living being. He could deal equally with all of them because he saw the real nature of every living being as a part and parcel of the Supreme Living Being. And therefore he was able to actually do good for everyone. But an ordinary person can't do that, no matter how hard they try or how nice their sentiments may appear to be. You know, just like Bill Gates, rich man. Was the richest man in the world, almost. Who knows what he's got left now after the stock exchange crash, but anyway. Shri Radha Gopinath Ki Jai. But he's given, they say, about $22 billion for altruistic work. He's put millions and millions of dollars into trying to find a cure for malaria because so many people die every year. So he's concerned about that, you know, there's no effective vaccine for the malaria disease, or people are not getting it. So let's spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to solve this problem. It sounds very nice, very laudable. But you know, the people that are dying of malaria, if they get that cure, does it mean that after you've cured them of malaria that they're not going to die? You know, they'll still die this year or next year or the year afterwards. Yeah, just curing malaria is not going to do anything to stop that. So this is a misguided sentiment. But this man's spending billions of dollars, you know, based on that ignorance. And everybody else who is in ignorance is worshipping him. They're, you know, glorifying him. Oh yes, he's such a big humanitarian and this and that and the other. Not that we say there's anything wrong with trying to help other living beings. But real help has to be based on actual knowledge. Otherwise, if you don't actually know what a living being is, you can't help anybody. And then your so-called help is just a show, that's all. So here then, anyway, it's said very specifically that the Supreme Lord, he doesn't discriminate between friends and so-called enemies, favorable or unfavorable. He's equally disposed to everyone. And anyone can avail themselves of that equality of disposition. Anybody can do that. The opportunity has been given. Not only that, it's not that Krishna's passive, you know, and standing back and say, well, okay, here I am. If you want, you can come. He's so favorably disposed, actually, that he's very actively trying to induce, you know, the fallen conditioned souls to come back to him. It's not like he's just kind of neutral. He's actually intervening at every moment in an attempt to bring us back to our natural, happy condition of life. Therefore, he comes himself in his so many different incarnations. Yeah, here we have the appearance day of Lord, the appearance of Lord Nisringadev. Yeah, and so there's so many incarnations. Prabhupada said there's so many incarnations, there's more than there are waves in the ocean. And they're unlimited. So how many incarnations can there be? And Krishna is entering into this material situation with the living beings as the Paramatma within their hearts. He's helping them in so many ways, supplying to them according to their desires and their activities. And at the same time, he's also arranged things in such an intelligent way that at a certain point that any living being in this material world will come to a certain level of consciousness where at least he can ask, why am I here and, you know, what life is and where am I going, what is going to be my future? That you have that gradual, you know, elevation. And no matter how fallen a living being may become or how distanced he may become from Krishna, he may take birth as a stone or a tree. Yeah, how, you know, what a situation of ignorance that is. Barely conscious at all. But somehow or another, Krishna is so merciful, he arranges it so that there's this gradual process of evolution of the living being up through all these different graduated species of life where they get a chance to enjoy themselves according to their desires. But at the same time, they make this incremental advancement in expansion of consciousness, self-awareness, till eventually they come to this human form, where one has the opportunity to become fully self-aware and then solve all the difficulties of life. So that's where we're at. And then we see the endeavor that Krishna makes for the living beings who have that opportunity to take full advantage of it. He appears himself, he displays his activities and his pastimes. He sends his pure representatives. He speaks the Shastra. Yeah, Guru, Sadhu and Shastra. These facilities are there in the human form. And so much endeavor is being made just to attract our attention back to the Supreme Lord. You know, to bring us back to this sense of our eternal relationship with him and thus solve all of our problems. So there's a huge endeavor that's being made. And this Krishna consciousness movement is one such endeavor. Prabhupada said it is my personal tiny effort. Yeah, he was started off with nothing, but of course he had Krishna. And because he had this tremendous vision, equality of vision. Prabhupada was very, very effective in helping, you know, all living beings from all over the world and bringing them back up to, you know, their natural happy state of life. That was what Prabhupada wanted. He said, that is my satisfaction, to see so many boys and girls dancing and chanting in ecstasy and taking prasadam. So that is the success of my mission. I was just reading the other day some notes that I was keeping in my diary when I was here in Bombay with Srila Prabhupada in 1976, just at the end. And Kaladri Prabhu had come from America. He was in New Brindaban for some time as the president. At that time, he was the president in Buffalo. But he had come and he was doing some purchasing and things for the New Brindaban Yatra. He brought with him a whole box full of milk sweets that were, maybe Radhanath Maharaj cooked them. I don't know. Maybe you were in the kitchen at 76, yeah? So he brought with him all these milk sweets that had been cooked in the kitchens of New Brindaban. All different varieties. And when he showed them to Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada just lit up, you know, a really bright smile. And he said, "This is the success of my movement." Yeah? He said that there can be such a place where we can get such nice foodstuffs. Yeah? Sweet success. Yeah? So Prabhupada was very happy. That was, you know, tangible evidence of the success of his mission, that now, in the middle of, you know, the dense forest of ignorance, America, you know, there's now at least one place where such nice, civilized foodstuffs, you know, could be obtained. Otherwise, you know, he used to remark, that's a symptom of your level of consciousness. You are, as they say, you are what you eat. So he would criticize the Westerners. All they know how to do is get a lump of meat, throw it in a pot, and cook it or fry it, and that's it. He said, but in India, he said, we have so many varieties of wonderful foodstuffs, and every region has their own particular flavors. That's a symptom of civilization, what you eat. So when Prabhupada saw those nice milk sweets coming from the milk of cows that are being protected, yeah, there, oh, he was very happy. This, he said, is the success of my movement. So, simple things, but they reflect the state of consciousness. Yeah, we can understand something by its symptoms. So in the same way then, Prabhupada, he would observe his disciples, and he would see how we're advancing in Krishna consciousness, yeah, by our actions. Yeah, by our enthusiasm to preach Krishna consciousness, you know, to worship the deities nicely, etc., etc. So, this is, you know, the perfection of life, Krishna consciousness. We can do it in this life, and we can do it beyond this life. We can continue with this wonderful service, you know, for all eternity. That is the gift that Prabhupada gave us. And he was able to do that because he didn't discriminate against one living being against another. Prahlad Maharaj also, because he was in the same frame of mind when he was asked by his father, what have you learnt at school? Have you learnt how to discriminate who is a friend and who is an enemy? Have you learnt the art of diplomacy? And he said, no, I'm not going to learn those things. Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, the Supreme Lord Vishnu is the master of all living beings. Every living being is his part and parcel. Therefore, how can I make these kinds of discriminations? I think this mentality of seeing friends and enemies is hellish. And of course, his father became infuriated by that. But that was Prahlad Maharaj's vision, his mood. He was a Mahabhagwat. And in that respect, I remember one time being in Brindaban with Srila Prabhupada, and he was preaching on some topic or other, and there was just myself and Srila Prabhupada in his room. And he quoted something from Prahlad Maharaj. And it just struck me at that moment that Srila Prabhupada was just perfectly in this mood of Prahlad Maharaj. That Prahlad Maharaj is, you know, Prabhupada was saying how Prahlad Maharaj's endeavor was, you know, to raise up all living beings and, you know, to do good for them. And as he was saying that, it just struck me so strongly. Prabhupada was almost like a personification or an embodiment of the teachings of Prahlad Maharaj. So I actually said it to him. I just couldn't resist it. And I said, it seems to me that, you know, you appreciate Prahlad Maharaj very much. You always seem to be in the mood of Prahlad Maharaj. And Prabhupada just grinned very brightly. He accepted it. So, you know, this is it's very appropriate. We can see the parallel there. Here's the story about Prahlad Maharaj. And he's saying, this is the attributes, this is the characteristics of the Supreme Lord. That he doesn't discriminate, make anybody higher or lower. He's equally disposed to everyone. He offers his help to everyone without any discrimination. In the same way, Srila Prabhupada was doing exactly the same thing. Yeah, and therefore, we have the good fortune of being able to take up, you know, Krishna consciousness. We have the good fortune of being able to come to this platform where we can leave all our baggage at the door, walk in to Radha Gopinath's Mandir, and become liberated souls. Yeah, become liberated from birth, death, disease, and old age. Become liberated from ignorance and all this confusion and suffering that comes as a result of that. That is, you know, a wonderful gift. And as we receive it, then we should also give that to others. So we have to learn how to see every living being as a spirit soul and not make discriminations, yeah, and then so-called friends and enemies. And feel favorable to some and hard done by others. Yeah, as soon as we start complaining, oh, he's a this, he's a that, he did this to me, that one did that one, I'm not going to do this for him, he never did anything for me. You know, that's not the platform of devotional life. The platform of devotional life is dasa dasanu dasa. Yeah, everybody is my master. I am the servant of every other living being. Yeah, every living being is a part and parcel of the Supreme Living Being, and therefore my only function is to offer my service, that's all. And if we have that mentality, immediately we become very happy. But if we get caught up in this mentality, friends and enemies, making these distinctions, oh, he's a higher, he's a lower, you know, no. Prabhupada instructed us, every devotee should refer to every other devotee as Prabhu. Yeah, means master. We were in New Delhi in March of 76, and Prabhupada was mentioning this point, and Gurudas was there. He was a sannyasi at that time. So he mentioned how, you know, we should have this mentality of seeing every living being, or every, at least every devotee, as being Prabhu. He said, not that we say, Gurudas, Prabhu, come here and polish my shoes. It should be, no, Gurudas, Prabhu, can I polish your shoes for you? Like that. So it was a nice, you know, exchange. And it reminded me, actually, of a story that a friend of mine had told me when we were kids. We were brought up in a kind of a iron and steel producing town in northern England, quite a, you know, desolate area, and not even a glimmer of anything spiritual. But anyway, this friend of mine, he was my best friend at school, he got some neighbors, and one of them was an Indian family, very nice people, and he said that when he went into their house, he said everything was spotless. It was so clean and nice. He really liked it. And he told us a story. His father told him a story about how he was in the war. And, you know, there was a division of the army that were all Indian troops. But many of the British troops, you know, the white British troops, they looked down on the Indian Corps, you know, as somehow or another lesser beings. Because that was the old colonial mentality. Yeah, the Indians are the white man's burden. So there was one friend of his, and there was an Indian soldier. So this friend of my friend's father, he was treating this soldier very badly, just because he was Indian, yeah, just because of the color of his skin. He was, you know, cursing him and calling him all kinds of names and just generally abusing him because he was thinking that he's better and this man is worse, you know, on the basis of his bodily identification. So what was the response? A couple of days later, this man woke up and he found that his boots, right, big army boots, were so nicely polished. And he hadn't done it. Of course, in the army, that's one of the things they have to do is keep your boots polished. Yeah, it's one of your chores. So this man woke up and he found his boots sitting there at the end of his bed. And they were so polished up, much better than he did it himself even. And he was thinking, who's done this? Who's polished my boots? And then, you know, this man was there, this Indian soldier. And he said, I did. And so this English soldier, he became so moved. He was so humble. And he'd done this, you know, act of polishing his boots. He became so moved by that, he started crying. And then, you know, he embraced him. He said, oh, I'm so sorry for abusing you in that way. Yeah. So then he appreciated. So that little bit of humility took away so much antagonism and hatred and, you know, because that's all artificial, this idea of friends and enemies. But that idea of service, which is the natural function of a living being, everybody can appreciate. So just by doing that one humble service, of polishing his boots, this man was completely won over. Yeah, and then they became friends. So that's a mundane example, but our Krishna consciousness movement is based on the same principle, that we're all dasa dasanu dasa. We're all the servants of all the other living beings. And if everybody has that mentality, then how nice the world would be. Yeah, immediately. So anyway, that's what Prabhupada gave us. He gave us this ability to see equally, to develop this equal vision. Because he had it, then we've also developed that same vision. We have to share it with everybody that we meet. Some people will appreciate, some people won't. That's not our concern. Yeah, Lord Chaitanya's mood was to break open the storehouse and distribute freely, without any discrimination, who is fit or who is not fit. Nobody's fit. If you really want the story, nobody's fit to receive it. But we go out and we just distribute as much as we can. And in that way then, you know, a wonderful Vaikuntha atmosphere can be created anywhere in the world. And that's what Prabhupada has given us. You go anywhere, you know, where there's an ISKCON temple, hopefully, there should be that nice mood of service. You can come and you can be welcomed anywhere you go, yeah, without any discrimination. So, okay, so it's getting a little late. We'll finish at that point. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Jan Masami Prabhu.
We understand from Prabhupada's books that the Madhyama Bhagavat, he discriminates in preaching for who's qualified to take up bhakti. And, you know, the Prabhupada sometimes used the term hospital? Was it the hospital principle or the you know, who should one give attention to, and who is it the hospital principal or the emergency ward principal or
whatever,
something like that. Yeah. So to not discriminate in distributing the fruits of love of God, seems that may be possible for an Uttama that descends to the Madhyama Bhagavat platform. But for the Madhyama Bhagavat that's on his way up, it seems that he may not have the potency. Actually, there was a description that I heard Giriraj Swami give on how Prabhupada was speaking, I think, in Kharagpur. And he was speaking very strongly about some bogus spiritual leaders. And then there was this very critical challenge that was given by a man. And he said, you should have Samadarshana. And then Prabhupada, he pointed to his Western disciples and said, this is my Samadarshana. So I'm wondering if you could clarify, the need for discrimination in preaching, and also, you know, this kind of like carte blanche, give the mercy out.
The discrimination that the preacher makes is not the same as the discrimination that a materialist makes. A materialist actually feels friendship or enmity to various living beings according to how they serve his sense gratification. If somebody pleases my senses and my mind, he's a friend. And if somebody doesn't please my senses and my mind, he's an enemy. That's material discrimination. But the discrimination that a preacher makes is between the Lord, the devotees, the innocent, and the envious. Now he has, you know, different ways of reciprocating with those different levels of being. The Supreme Lord he worships, the devotees he associates with very eagerly, the innocent he extends his mercy to, and the envious he avoids. But it's not that he's thinking that this envious person is my enemy. Just like Prahlad Maharaj, he was, you know, attacked by his own father in so many different ways. But when he was asked by Lord Nisringadev, what benediction do you want? I'll give you anything. He said, please take my father back to Godhead. Yeah. So he wasn't feeling any enmity towards his own father. But because of the behavior of his father, he couldn't deal with him, you know, in a proper way. So he had, you know, there was some other arrangement that had to be made for that. So when a preacher comes across an envious person, he has to discriminate that this person is not yet ready to accept the message of Krishna consciousness. Not only that, but if I approach him, he may cause some disruption. And therefore, you know, he'll cause some difficulty in other innocent living beings receiving the message. So better to just avoid him. But he's not feeling, you know, oh, he's an enemy. He still has that same vision, you know, same feeling towards him. He's a spirit soul, but he's just more bewildered. But pragmatic. Yeah. In order to preach, you have to make some discriminations of action. But it's not a discrimination of, you know, consciousness, feeling towards those different living beings. Prabhupada used to like to give the example of Jesus when he was put on the cross. Yeah, he didn't, you know, condemn the people that was doing it. You know, rather he asked, you know, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. So that's the mood. Yeah, condemn the sin but not the sinner. That's another saying that the Christians have. So, we make a distinction between the Lord and the ordinary living entities. We're not Mayavadis. We worship the Lord. We associate with the devotees. In different ways, reciprocal ways. And we have some feeling of, you know, compassion for the living entities that are in ignorance. There's so many out there, they don't know, they're bewildered, you know, who they really are and what they're supposed to be doing with their human forms of life. And they're losing a valuable opportunity. So we go out and we try to help them. Some people will immediately be receptive. So we encourage them. The more receptive they are, the more we give them. And some people are less receptive. So what can be done? You can try. But if they don't want it... And that same morning walk that I mentioned about Gurudev and Prabhupada, you know, bringing up this exchange about Prabhu, seeing everybody as Prabhu. Gurudev had asked Srila Prabhupada how Kripa Siddhi works. Yeah. How a person becomes perfect just by mercy alone. Yeah. Not Sadhana Siddhi or, you know, Nitya Siddha. But Kripa Siddha, how does one become a Kripa Siddha? So then Prabhupada said, that comes, he said, just like he said, if I have a bag with $100,000 in it, and I say, here, Gurudev, take $100,000. And Prabhupada was acting it out as if he actually had a bag in his hands, and he shoved Gurudev in his stomach, and he was saying, take it, take it, take it. And Gurudev was like laughing. And Prabhupada said, and if you don't take it, he said, then what can I do? He said, I'm offering you free. Here, take it, take it. He said, that is Kripa Siddhi. So that is the position of a devotee. They have that Kripa, yeah, mercy. Take it, take it. It doesn't matter. You know, who you are, what you are, just take it. Some form or another, give them some mercy. That's all. If you don't want to take it, then what can be done? But there's no, you know, discrimination on the part of a devotee. Any other questions or comments? One over there.
Hare Krishna Prabhu, thank you for a great class today. I was wondering, do you know of Srila Prabhupada making any predictions about the downfall of the American civilization?
Did he make any predictions about the downfall of the American civilization? The first question is whether the Americans actually have a civilization. Then we can speak about whether they're going to fall down from it. No, Kali Yuga means everything will deteriorate automatically. You only have to look at the history of any so-called civilization and you see, you know, they're all doomed. They all get, you know, they deteriorate, then some other more powerful group of living beings come in, you know, there's so many empires, the Mayan Empire, the Incan Empire, even, you know, the Indians in North America, not your Indians, the other Indians, the Red Indians, you know, up until 200 or 300 years ago, North America, it was not, you know, an empty, vast, empty continent. It was heavily populated with huge settlements of Red Indians all over the whole continent. They were farming, you know, they were tending actually huge herds of buffalo, and that had gone on for many, many centuries. But then, you know, in the 1800s, the white guys came in, and then immediately, you know, they started pushing them back, and now there's a few Indians left on the reservations. Their entire culture and civilization has disappeared. It's just gone. Thousands of years, maybe, it was there, but now it's gone. And people lament, but that's, you know, the history of Kali Yuga. The Roman Empire, where is it? It's gone. You know, the Greek Empire, where is it? It's gone. The British Empire, where is it? It's gone. So similarly, the Americans have got, you know, their day in the sun. And that will also go. It's inevitable. So, you know, one thing is always replacing another. Nothing remains as it is. Shri Radha Gopinath Ki Jai. We can guarantee that the so-called civilization that exists right now is not going to last. It's artificial. You know, and especially we can see just, you know, with this monetary crisis that's going on now, just how tentative their so-called wealth actually is. They don't have any real wealth. They think that their wealth is printed on a piece of paper. That's not wealth. Prabhupada told us real wealth is the land. Real wealth is food. Real wealth is having a shelter, a home to live in. Real wealth is, you know, having at least some medicine. If you can get those four things, grow your own food, build your own houses, grow your own medicine and cloth. You have to wear something. Make your own cloth. Then he said that's all you need to live a happy life. And real civilization means spiritual cultivation. That's civilization. Otherwise, if you don't have that spiritual component, it's not civilization. It's animal life. So all we're seeing is just, you know, a very superficial so-called veneer of so-called civilization. But it's not real civilization, and therefore it must collapse. It will collapse. We can say it for sure. So you don't have to be, you know, a big astrologer to predict that. You know, even, you know, the ordinary karmis, they all know if we continue the way we are right now, you know, what is this civilization? It is a consumer civilization. Consume everything in sight without any care, without any regard, without any mercy on other living beings. Consume all the cows, consume all the turkeys, all the ducks, all the chickens, you know, consume all the resources of the planet. What will you be left with? Ashes, that's all. And they're all seeing that now. The planet is actually, you know, being consumed by this voracious imitation civilization. Because people are misdirected and they have no spiritual understanding. They don't know what the planet is. They don't know the relationship with the planet or anything else. They think material nature is there to be conquered and enjoyed. That's what it is. It is a civilization of consumers, a civilization of enjoyers at any cost. And now they're just, some of them are starting to wake up and realize that the ultimate cost is themselves. Yeah, they're going to end up consuming themselves. After they've consumed everything else, they'll end up consuming themselves. That's the future of Kali Yuga. It's just like a cancer. A cancer is where the body eats itself, right? It's just the body somehow or another begins to malfunction and it begins eating itself. That's what's happening. That's what you're seeing going on. So, Prabhupada, you know, whether Prabhupada said it or anybody else said it, yes, the American civilization is going to come to an end. And Prabhupada's idea was to replace that before it does so with a spiritually based civilization, which is sustainable. Spiritual life means it's sustainable. Yeah, mode of goodness, maintenance. That's spiritual life. That's real civilization. Civilization in the mode of ignorance and passion is not real civilization. It's animal life. When the civilization is dictated by goodness, Satwagun, then it's sustainable. But maintenance only happens on the platform of goodness, not on the platform of passion and ignorance. So we have to transform human society by introducing that component, Satwagun or Sudasatwa. Then it will sustain, otherwise not. Okay, it's very late. We should finish there. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.